Welcome back to the Wolf of Queen Street podcast series. Today on the episode, Marvin Solerio, a trained actor, personal trainer, a podcast from the High Frequency Club, but also an immigrant to New Zealand, and a long backstory of a lot of tick boxes and worldly experiences that I think society needs to learn about, hear about. And one of the people, you know, going through, as I've said always on my show, I stalk my guests in a really polite way that and I was talking to Will that's producing today. Is this going to be interesting, the show today, because I think we've got the batshit energy between the both of us the same. So it'll be interesting to see how the show goes, how it comes across. Your positive view on the world of changing people's lives is amazing. And I thought I'd, Marvin, get you on the show and have a chat about it.
Awesome, bro. Thanks for having me on. I feel gassed up already. Yes, appreciate it, bro.
No, that's awesome, man. So as one thing I'd like to cover from the beginning, and I think it's really important, you know, relatable to myself being an immigrant in New Zealand. I was born in South Africa. I know you were born in the Philippines, and your dad took that step to get an opportunity for yourself by the age of five for you to come over to New Zealand. As I want to just touch on that and how much that molded to what you are today and your thought patterns around what your dad took those steps to give you that opportunity. Because I know you didn't come over to Auckland, you came over to Taupo, a little bit of, you know, beautiful place, still is, but, you know, 20 years ago it would have been different to what it is today.
So I was born in the Philippines when I was 3 years old, when my father realized that he couldn't feed the family, me and my sister at the time and my mother. He ended up moving to Papua New Guinea first and then moved to New Zealand. So by the time I was five, he had saved up enough money for me, my mum, my sister to immigrate to Taupo, New Zealand, as you said. Throughout my entire childhood, spent it in Taupo. And then I was pretty much not the only, I think there was like a handful of other Filipinos there. So I gravitated towards them. And then when they left at an early age, I ended up gravitating towards, you know, the Maldives and the islanders, because those were the people that I could relate to the most. And it wasn't until I came to Auckland where I started to meet other Filipino friends. But before then, I actually hated being Filipino. I hated it because I felt different from everyone else. So I actually changed, not legally, but whenever people would ask me what my name was, I'd tell them my name was Maui, because it was more relatable to the Maoris and the islanders and stuff like that, right? And it wasn't until, I came to Auckland where I actually started to embrace my Filipino culture. But regardless of feeling the shame of being Filipino to the external world, I never felt that shame within my family. Like the values of family first, of respect and kindness, the traditional Filipino values were always rooted within me. And I loved being Filipino at home, and I loved bringing friends into my Filipino home and sharing the gifts of food and, you know, and all of that. I think I'm asked often whether I have ever felt obliged to pay my parents back. And I've always tossed up against that, because not necessarily, but I feel more obliged to make the most out of the opportunity that they have given me. And I say that because I came to that realization.
But do you feel that? At what stage did you feel that obligation or that? Because a lot of people come over, young kids from immigrant parents, right? And there's two ways. You'll feel the sacrifice your parents have made and willing to want to support or push or the thanks towards them. And some of them will just take it for granted and will never understand, you know, that side of what it did. Like at your age now, I know it's been a bit of time, but now growing up, did you feel almost the sacrifice or that your dad did to give you guys that opportunity?
Absolutely. I remember coming up to Auckland to study acting. And before then, my father wanted me to be in the Navy. He wanted me to be an engineer, you know, the Asian big five, doctor, lawyer, nurse. But I really wanted to study acting. And I remember going to Auckland, and it was just me and my dad in the car because he was helping me move. I said, "Dad, I'm sorry that I'm not going to be what you want me to be," because I felt that obligation that we're talking about right now, right? I'm like, fuck, I really want to be successful in the eyes of my parents. And my dad stops the car and he says, "Son, that's not what truly matters. What really matters is that you're happy. So it doesn't matter whether you're acting or you're a nurse or you're an engineer, as long as you're happy." So that made me realize in that moment that my father made all the sacrifices, not for me to be successful in their eyes, yep. but to be happy in their eyes and be happy within myself. So that switched my mindset of an obligation to pay them back because of their sacrifices, mm-hmm. and instead an obligation to make the most out of the opportunity of the privilege that they've given me because of their sacrifices. That makes sense.
Yes, 100%. And it's amazing to see that because as a parent myself, my kids are teens and stuff, you still want them to strive. And it's funny, I just recorded a show just yesterday before this recording, and we spoke about that same thing. As a parent, you almost want to impose what you feel onto that child, right? Onto your child and the success and all the rest of it. And you got to go take a step back and go, no, it's not what you want. It's what they want to become and allow them to grow and blossom and, you know, and happiness. And I think it's one of the biggest things I've learned this year with my kids. Yeah. And it's so true. Their happiness is more important than the tick boxes. And it's funny because, you know, going through high school, my daughter's going through high school, my son's starting high school in a couple of years' time, and you got that whole view of, oh, you got to be really good at high school. You got to be really successful. And I always think back about the story that my dad always tells me, and he goes, Lawrence, at the end of high school, let's say there's a class of 30 kids at any set high school, whether, you know, and out of those 30 kids, irrespective of who's top and who's bottom, there'll be one doctor, there'll be one lawyer, there'll be one policeman, there'll be one judge, there'll be 10 office workers, there'll be 10 people that would just go on and, you know, not do anything with lives. And that'll be the same irrespective of what class or what school, because society just allows that to go, you know? So you're almost like, you don't have to go, hey, you do this, you do this. It'll naturally blossom if it's allowed. If that kid in the society and that situation is allowed to blossom, they will grow that way naturally.
Yeah, yeah. I only realized that once I came to Auckland and met some other Filipino friends, some new Filipino friends, that when I shared that story with them, they were like, oh, yeah, our parents did the exact same one. And you're like, when you have 10 Filipino friends saying that their parents did the exact same thing, those five jobs, then you start to realize that, oh, yeah, these are just preconceived ideas that our parents have on success.
Yeah.
And it's their representation of stability, you know? And I guess, I don't know, I'm not a parent. I assume the thing that a parent really wants for their children is at least stability for them to, when they pass, they know they're going to be okay. Is that right?
Interesting one. I'll look over to Walt because he's got a younger family as well. At the moment, as a parent, you want them to be happy, but there's that conniving thing of when you got a really young kid, and Will might agree from me behind the cameras, is when they're very young, it's all about, cool, they walk the first, they spoke first, they're the tallest, right? And Will's nodding his head, right? And it's all of those, hey, my kid's in the 90th percentile. And then you look back and go, this doesn't mean shit. Mm. But then the problem is that feeds into young childhood, into teenhood, and it feeds into that whole mentality of my kid should always be first and be the best and strive to be the best and achieve the best. And then you get this teenager that might strive. You get the 1% that's going to kick ass and take names and be the fucking best in the world. And then you're going to have the 1% on the other side that's not. And they're going to be content and they're going to be happy. And then you're going to push that 1% on this side. And then we get into the dilemmas of kids that don't know what they are, who they are, what they should be doing, the mental health struggles that come with it, because this is where their space is. And their ambassadors and people that's supposed to be empowering them is saying, go from year to year. So it's a real interesting space. And I thought I'd just bring this in because it's amazing to see, and we need more of it, of parents that have the understanding and the support of, my child is not going to tick this tick box. They're going to tick that tick box, and I'm going to support them and let them be happy. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm so grateful of my upbringing, my parents, and the way they raised me. Definitely, they gave me the freedom and the autonomy to just be who I am.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that, to anyone that doesn't know or is learning about Marvin at the moment, is you can see that through you as a personality and a person. You can see that freedom of doing what you want and not giving a fuck about the world and doing what is your strengths comes across naturally in your life, in your personal training, you know, from your acting side and everything you do, is because you've always been told, go where you're happy. And not go where you're supposed to go. So literally, you know, there's days where we all in society go, I wish I could do what made me happy. And you've been allowed to do that since day one, right? And allowed that freedom. Don't get me wrong, there's the stumbling blocks and all the rest of it along the way. But it just comes across so different in people that people that do the shit that make them happy.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for acknowledging that, bro.
Yeah, because like I said, yeah, your energy levels and the other things you do is just, it's off the chart and all the rest of it. Mm. So last thing on that, how's your relationship with your dad and your family now?
Really good, really good. If anything, I'm trying to actually spend more time with them now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, my parents are still in Taupo. I obviously live here in Auckland. Yeah. And there was a point, especially when I started uni, right up until I started building my business as a personal trainer, where I wasn't going home that often. Yep. But now as I'm old, I'm 31 now, every time I go home, I can see my parents getting older.
Yeah.
You know, my father is starting to take shape of your stereotypical Asian man, where he's, you know, losing his muscle mass, he's getting skinnier. They just look older. And
jeez, can I get those jeans? I'm getting older, I'm getting wider. I'm not getting smaller, mate. I'm getting bigger as I'm getting older.
So I'm just trying to spend more and more time with them. And I understand where they come from in terms of why they raised us the way that they did. So I have even more empathy towards my parents now.
You ever told your dad thank you?
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually told my father, I wonder if he'll listen to this, that I love him.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing this self-development course that was like intensive for 3 fucking days. And one of the tasks was that tell someone who you haven't told before how much you really feel about them. And I know I'm going to have fellow Asians right now listening. Emotional connection is not a big thing.
In that. Yep, that's 100%. Yeah.
It was the same for you.
My dad is an ex-military man. Mm. So that's a little bit, you know, it's not a cultural thing. It'll be a societal thing with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So me growing up with my dad, ex-military man, it was black and white.
Mm.
And that used to go the wrong way for many, many years as well. And then we had the situation that we both came over together. And then it was, we always lived next door to each other. So then you had the challenge as I grew older, you had the old line and the new line.
Mm.
So in the same space. And you had the challenge of who's the line?
Yeah.
Who's the lead of the family? And that took many, many years to understand.
Oh, wow.
And we've finally got to a space now that we respect each other's space and have full love for each other and know where we stand. And that took, I think, only till my mid-30s, realistically, to know where we as two men are stubborn as exactly the same. And I think it came to the biggest part was me accepting that I'm almost same as him.
Yeah.
For many years, you go, no, I'm not the same as my dad.
Yeah.
I'm not like that. I'm different than the rest. And you forget, we are unique to what our parents are. We go on our own ways, but they do feed down to us of our morals, our understandings, our beliefs, and what is good and what is bad.
Mm.
And then it's for us to take along. So, yeah, so interesting one for myself. And that's why I thought I would ask you. And I would like to you to go back to that 3-day thing about saying your dad
so
about love.
So one of the tasks was call someone that you haven't talked to or you haven't told that you love them, tell them how you really feel. And the first person that came to my mind was my father.
Yeah.
Never have I ever told my dad that I love him or vice versa.
Yeah.
So I called him. The first time I chickened out and I was just talked about the weather, talked about how he was. And then I had to do it again. Second time, called him up and I told him, Dad, I just really want you to know that I really appreciate you and I thank you for your sacrifices. It's helped me be there. And he says, stop. And I'm like, pardon? And he goes, you don't need to say this. And I was like, what do you mean? And he says, I already know all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay. And he goes, it's all good. Are you all good? I was like, yep. But my heart is breaking at this point because I have conjured up the courage to articulate how I truly feel about my father. And he's just interrupted me and told me to stop. I hang up the phone and I cry. I cry the whole afternoon. I was like, I can't believe him. Fuck him. He doesn't even want to listen to me. How dare he? And then I, not in that moment, but later on, I read the book or I saw the book, The 5 Love Languages, and I realized then that my father's way of showing love and receiving love was not words of affirmation. Yeah. For him, it's quality time.
Yeah.
And that was his way of telling me and I telling him, I love you. So once I understood that about my mom and my dad, that is why now I go home so much more often. Because that's their way of knowing that their son loves them and vice versa. And so even if me and my father are just sitting across the table and we're not saying anything, to him, that is the best.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a while for me to get my head wrapped around that because I want to know How you been, Dad? Yeah. What's been going on? What's been taking up rent in your head? How's the cafe? Mm-hmm. How are you and Mum like? But he will never go into that. Mm-hmm. He'll just give me the surface, and he's just happy being in each other's space. That's my relationship with them now. Again, goes back to just a deeper sense of empathy, meeting them where they are, not where I expect them to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a learning through life. I have a lot of the similar experiences, right? Like now, you know, my dad will openly speak about, and you say, I love you, and a lot more now. It's just funny because my kids, so his grandkids, softened him through his time.
Mm.
Like he was always this hard case, and once he had grandkids, a lot of that softened, and then that love and emotional side came out that we'd never seen before, and then, and blossomed more. But it's so funny how you say you can sit in company and don't have to say anything.
Mm.
I do that with my dad all the time. So we'll go out somewhere and I'm like, okay, cool. I need to drive from my house to somewhere else and it's an hour away. Or he's got to do it. And he's like, oh, come drive with me. We will drive for an hour and not say a word.
Yeah.
And have no issue with it.
Yeah.
And we'll sit in each other's coming forward. But it's funny because we'll drive and then like he always says to me, like in the first moment, he goes, so what's new?
Mm.
And if but we forget, we live next door to each other. So most days, some days we don't see each other for days, and some days we see each other every single day for half the day. Mm-hmm. So then the next day you'll go, oh, what's new? And it'll be like, oh, nothing much. Yeah. And for an hour we just stay quiet.
Yeah.
But that's the language of how, you know, we speak. And then there's other days where we're talking and laughing and all that sort of stuff, but it never needs to be or one way or the other way, right?
Mm, yeah. I do remember the first time, because me and my dad, whenever we greeted each other, it was always a handshake.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, fuck this. I'm going for the hug. One day I was like, you know what? I'm going to, you know, take a leap of courage and I'm going to go for the hug.
Yeah.
And I remember him being a robot. He was like, duh, 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 duh. Yeah. But in time, he softened to that.
Yeah.
He softened more to that. Now that is like the standard, which I'm glad for.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a weird one because a lot of people getting shocked. I don't know if you know this. So in South Africa, the culture is we kiss a lot.
Right.
We kiss on the lips.
True.
True.
You would kiss your father on the lips.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You kiss family, friends on the lips, hi, goodbye.
Yeah.
It's part of the culture, specifically the Afrikaans culture. Now, I remember this was quite a big shock. First time my wife went over, oh, geez, 20 years ago, when we'd only been together about a year, and she came over the first time. And my good friend at that stage, so we were, you know, early 20s, and my good mate walked right over, gave a cuddle and gave a kiss on the lips. And she turned around, she's like, Lawrence, your mate just kissed me on the lips. What's going on? And then I was like, no, it's fine, don't worry. And then what freaked out even more is his sister came over,
mm-hmm.
and she kissed her on the lips. And she's like, what the hell is going on? A girl just kissed me on the lips. Like, what is going on in this country? But yeah, so like same with that, like when like my parents, if they were travel and stuff, my dad or even my mom, he'd come over, cuddle and give a kiss and things like that. So you always had like, I would always add the cuddle and the kiss before almost the I love you.
Yeah.
Because that was almost like a culture, like it's a handshake to go. Like you said, your culturally, yours to go away was a handshake, yeah, with yeah. us was like a kiss.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so that was accepted. And to other people, that would show almost more signs of love.
Yeah.
But it's unique in its way from a culture point of view.
That's so funny. So, did you preface to your partner that this is what's going
to be? Yeah, I told her that. Like, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things back in South Africa from a culture one. Like another weird one just on the side of this is, in the Afrikaans culture, we have they're called sokkies or dances, where you go and there's the typical music that is playing, Afrikaans music, and it's like old school, you know, if the couple is a long arm and, you know, or wind sailing, as you're calling it, in a specific way you dance. You'll go into the smaller townships, more small towns or communities, and they'll have this like dance going on, old school dance. And I assure you not, this is the weirdest thing. You'll go there and you know there'll be, say, 40 couples or say like 100 people there, and husband and wife are dancing there, husband and wife are dancing there, and a couple's dancing here, a couple dancing here. And without a doubt, there'll be a guy that might not be with a partner, he might not have a girlfriend and stuff, and he wants to dance. He will walk over to another dude. I've seen this and go, hey, dude, hey, Marvin, you have a jam? And he has two guys going for a dance.
Yeah,
and
right, it's
nothing sexual or anything. And I remember the first time, again, my wife seen this. She's like, Lawrence. And we're at this very, very small town full with a lot of rugby guys. There was a tournament on and stuff. And she's like, Lawrence, there's very big rugby boys are dancing with each other, like holding hands and dancing. She's like, what is going on here?
Mm.
And then you'll see the same, like girls will go up. And then again, which is another one is like, I would walk over. So if I knew your partner or your wife and you were sitting down and having a drink, I'd be like, Marvin, are you going to dance? And you'd be like, no. And I'd be like, oh, cool. Do you want to come for a dance? Mm. And you would take another guy's girl. Now, some dudes, you know, you knew didn't do that.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys, yeah. So you would see this sort of weird cultural way of relationship and friendship and stuff like that, you know? So it's quite cool.
It is cool. Yeah, I had to preface to my partners who met my parents, they're quiet.
Yeah.
So don't take it personally. It's not that they don't like you. They just honestly, their love is quality time. If they weren't spending time with you, they wouldn't like you. So it's all good if it's all quiet.
We are South Africans, we're loud. So we have to warn people that it's very loud.
Yeah.
And when my mom and my dad and myself get in a room and we're having a discussion, it sounds like an argument. And if we go into Afrikaans, it sounds like there's a war going to break out because you get like this German backfill and people look at us and like, I'm scared. Something's going to happen because it's such like an aggressive language, right? And it gets loud and everything else. But no, that's amazing.
Awesome.
So look, you know, you go through all of that. You know, your passion was acting. Mm. You came to Auckland to study performing arts, right?
That's
got
right.
through all the rest of it. I know you still wish to, you know, want to be on TV all day, but I know it's not a field like, you know, Will again producing at the back there. The other producer guy is actually a film producer, acts himself.
Yeah.
I know you said it. It's not a career you find in New Zealand that pays daily or day job, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's only a handful of people that get paid full time and well in New Zealand from full time acting. And I think it's the people on Shortland Street. And they're like the core cast. I don't know. Maybe there's like only 10 or 12 of them, you know.
Yeah.
There are an abundance of actors here in New Zealand.
Yeah, totally. And high quality as well, right? Mm. And you know, the movies that have come out of New Zealand and people that love it here as well.
Yeah.
You know, I've done a few bits behind camera and done TV ads and all the rest of it. And it's a love piece and a passion piece, but it's never going to be a career piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you find yourself from, you know, having the freedom of your dad and support of the family, going into the acting, doing the you know, the degree? How did you go from that to personal trainer?
So like we've just touched on now is that I knew there was not going to be any lots of jobs for me, especially at that time. So in my second year, I packed on a whole lot of weight because the student life was so fun. It was just partying and eating what you could afford. So that was like Domino's, KFC and Coronas. I got all the way up to 90 kgs. And if you know me, I'm a small motherfucker, you know, 90 kgs to me, I look like Kung Fu Panda. So I was like, you know what? It's time. I actually started to get stretch marks.
Yeah.
And then I looked at them one time, they were small. I looked at them the next week and they got bigger and bigger. And I didn't know anything about the body or health at that time. So I thought those stretch marks were going to grow right up to my neck. And I thought that no woman would like me because of how I would look. So I started going to the gym. I lost all that weight. All my classmates started to ask me, Marwan, how did you do it? I started to take them to the gym. And then my classmate was like, Marwan, you know, you could get a job doing this. And I was like, oh, doing what? And she was like, personal training. And I was like, okay, cool. So as soon as I finished acting school, I went to PT school knowing that I could get one, a full-time job out of that, and two, the autonomy to drop it if I ever got an acting role or whatever. So that's how I got started in personal training. And then 9 years later, I'm still here doing it.
You're still across with, because we went into Les Mills, right?
Yeah.
So where's the house for home for you now? Still Les Mills?
No. So I was Les Mills personal training for, I think it was 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So in the last 2 years, I've actually been at my own home. So since the most recent lockdown in 2021, I ended up getting some exercise gear. We didn't know how long we were going to be in there for. So I kept getting some more. Then I came to the realization, among other factors as well, that I didn't need Les Mills anymore to generate my leads.
Mm-hmm.
I was generating leads through social media, through referrals. So I thought, you know what? I'm done paying a weekly rent at Les Mills. I've got enough gear in my home.
Yep.
It was just a matter of finding the right house and the right flatmates to be okay with that for me running a business. And that's where I've been.
Talk me through I'm always interested about the Les Mills model, which is, or not just the Les Mills model. Let's not put out that I need them to come chase me. Look, I understand their brand. I'm just not a big fan of the brand because I think it's a brand that produces pretty people, not good people.
Mm.
So, and you can tell me if I'm wrong. So I've had some, because I've worked in town heaps. I was always next to the town, so Les Mills, and I'm assuming that's, you know, it produced pretty people, not good people that came out of that space. But talk me through how it works, because if there's anyone that's listening at the moment from in the personal training world, of it's the same as like a barber, right? You've got a pay to have your chair or pay to have access
yeah.
to that space. What's the general model that works as a personal trainer in a gym?
So I can only speak on the Les Mills part. So yep. you pay an X amount per week. As a new trainer, I ended up getting support from the manager. Also, they've got membership consultants where new people who would come to sign up to the gym can refer you.
Yep.
But yeah, it is a like all like as you know, being self-employed, it's a dog eat dog world. Sometimes
yep.
it's competitive. You have access to all these members, but then how do you advertise yourself to all of them? How do you allow them or make them pick you to be their personal yep. trainer? So
And you're always losing a cut of it. You're always losing a cut of it when you're under the Les Mills or you're under a gym, right? So if some come and see you, don't get all the money from it.
No. Oh, so as long as I paid my weekly rent to yep. Les Mills, they were all good.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, yep. So that was it.
Yep.
So most gyms are in that model.
Yep.
Most gyms. There are other gyms that I've heard of where they'll take like, I don't know, $10 out of every single session.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And walking away from that and taking clients, did you have to break it clean and find new clients or you couldn't take anyone with you?
No, I took all of my clients.
Yeah.
I took all my clients with me. I still also teach group fitness classes at Les Mills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a gray area because usually you're not allowed to have a conflict of interest.
Yep.
But thankfully, they saw enough value in me to keep me as a group fitness mm-hmm. instructor and also PT somewhere else.
Yep.
So because I had built such an established client base, because a lot of my clients I've been training for like over 4 years,
mm-hmm.
that they just, I'm grateful for it. They changed their routine to come to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's true to, again, to the essence of what you're on, what you do. So yes, it's personal trainer, you know, as the title, but it's, I know a lot of what you do personally is it's personal trainer, it's mom, it's dad, it's brother, it's sister, it's support, it's guidance. Because a lot of what you look at, and I know you've mentioned this before, is you're not just there to get someone physically fit, you're also there to get someone mentally fit or get someone through other situations where, you know, the training is part of it, but not entirely all of it.
Yeah.
And I know that's true to your values around your brand of, hey, if I came to you and, look, dude, I need to lose weight, but I can't be arsed. But if I came to you and said, hey, I want to lose 25 kgs, to you, the important isn't about you making me lose 25 kgs. Important for you is about why am I doing it and what is actually behind that and helping that grow in myself. And I think that's true to why a lot of the people that I see that in around your space support your brand because of that.
Mm, yeah, thanks for that, bro. Yeah, there's a reason why the personal comes before the training.
Yeah.
Right? And also, we all know what to do. We all know what to do to get healthy.
Yeah.
But why don't we all do it? And I came to that question midway through my personal training career. Actually, no, in my second year of personal training, I was like, what the hell? It's exercise more, eat in moderation or eat a little bit less.
Mm-hmm.
How come the adherence is very, very low?
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized two things. One, everyone's got their own version of health and fitness and success. And not everyone sees it my way,
yep.
right? And secondly, there are so many other barriers to people getting into
mm-hmm.
whatever their goal is. So I needed to speak more about those barriers and how to eliminate them, what's going to get them into the gym first, or actually what's going to get them moving, and also really clarify what is your version of health and success?
Yep.
Because what I think about it isn't going to be the same as you.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of that was I had a client who I had going into a usual monthly check-in where we go into the consultation room and I check her weight. I do her measurements and, you know, figure out her body fat and muscle mass and blah, 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 blah. Once that was all done, there was this awkward silence because I was still trying to, you know, jot down my notes. And then she goes, I feel body shamed. And I was like, what? She goes, I just feel body shamed. And man, that hit me hard. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm sorry, client X. That's not my intention.
Yeah.
How did you come to that feeling? What made you feel that way? And she said, this has got nothing to do with how I measure my success. How I measure my success is the weights that I lift in the gym. I know that I'm getting stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I'm able to have more energy to play with my children. I can go traveling and be pain-free.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm already healthy and fit. I didn't need this.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I've been measuring your success the way I think health and success should be, when, and I've been completely blind that you've been winning this whole time, you know? So from that moment, I now ask way more questions on how you, Lawrence, would see health, fitness, and success. How would you define that? How would you measure that? Rather than me telling you what health, fitness, and success is. Because, you look around in the marketing and the ads and everything, they'll tell you. Mm. If you don't clarify what health, fitness, and success looks and feels like for you, society will tell you.
Yeah.
And you'll end up chasing something that you may not necessarily want or need, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it is so true, right? And it's that perception of where we need to go towards, to what is true to ourselves, right? And understanding ourselves. And it's so good. It's so good that from your understanding that you have that point, because one of the big questions I wanted to ask you, like you said, you've been in the game, 9 years now, you said, in the personal training game, is what I'd like to know from you, from your vibe and everything going in it. And because you are a lot more holistic than you might see from other coaches out there, right? I'm not saying there aren't other holistic coaches as out there. How is, and this is something big to myself and to the show, is how is people's attitude, mental health, perception of society at the moment, because that's stuff you are paying attention to. How have you seen that over the last few years change or pivot and stuff like that? Are you seeing trends? Because I mean, obviously in New Zealand, we're struggling with mental health, depression, all those other issues that's related. You know, are you seeing it in your clients?
Yeah, I remember when I first started, and I can even speak on it because I was a part of that machine. I started with the bodybuilding trend, right? So for me, it was all about vanity metrics. Yeah. And that's how I came to that belief that in order to be healthy and fit, you had to be lean and you had to be muscular. You had to look a certain way. But then once I came out of that bodybuilding scene, I remember about to go on stage because I did a bodybuilding show. And I was looking around, I was like, oh, I wonder where the people are that I'm meant to be competing against, because everyone here is huge.
Yeah.
They cannot be in my class. Yeah. And I asked the promotion manager, I was like, hey, am I competing against anyone else? And they're like, they're right beside you, bro. And I was like, oh my God. And in that moment, I realized the only way for me to succeed as a bodybuilder is to get on drugs.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't on for that. Mm-hmm. So straight after the show, I asked myself, you know what? I'm not going to go down that path. What's most important to me is the feeling. How do I feel? I want to feel stronger. I want to feel more confident. And now I'm seeing more and more people, especially in that bodybuilding space, actually start talking about that now everything is going upside down, right? And even more so now, because a lot of my clients are office people or corporate people, busy 9 to 5, mothers, fathers, parents. At first, they might be keen on the vanity metrics, but deep down, when you really ask the right questions, what they really want to do is just have more energy and feel more confident. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a matter of blasting that message out as loud as possible to make it feel like it is normal to want that rather than, because right now, the vanity metric is the most loudest.
Yeah. No, it's true. And people don't realize, like, I've been in the bodybuilding scene many, many years ago when I was a lot fitter than I am now, and got to meet Phil Heath, Mr. Olympia, and I was big in the scene. Well, there is, people don't realize how dark a place that is, how I stepped away from it because where my mind went and how bad it went. And then I actually had to step away for 6 months and never go into the gym for 6 months because how, like, engrossed and depressed and got to the point, like, you know, you weighing everything and you measuring everything and you missed this one rep or you missed this one calorie. It got to that level and you was like depressed the whole day because I should have done that yesterday. I should have done that one little stuff. And people don't realize how, you know, malnutrition affects people and how you see all these people at these competitions, at the physique competitions or men's health and the body, they're the most unfittest people there.
Yeah.
Not from a looks point of view, but unhealthiest. Sorry, that's a better word. They are so unhealthy by the time they climb on that stage. A lot of them, there's been guys that have collapsed and heart attacks and all the rest of it because it's a pure vanity. It's not a pure benefit, right?
Yeah. I completely, bodybuilding is an extreme sport, an extreme outcome, extreme processes, right? But even if we just take it right back to just everyday people who may be listening right now, if we look at a spectrum, there's optimal and there's suboptimal. And what you were touching on before is that the more optimal you want to be, the more trade-offs you are going to have to make, you know? Not everyone needs to be at that max optimal because just think about the trade-offs. You have to start weighing shit. You have to stop going out to social dinners. You know, you have to be so rigid on your sleep routine. Not everyone can do that when you're working a fucking 9 to 5.
Yeah.
You know, life is so spontaneous. But you also don't want to be at suboptimal where you're operating at like a 3 out of 10 energy every single day, where you don't feel good upon yourself, you know, where you can't spend time with your children or anything like that. So it's about really figuring out where on that spectrum you want to be and being okay with the trade-offs that you want to make, right? Like, I'm okay not being the leanest personal trainer. I'm fine. I know that in order for me to be leaner, I'm going to have to make trade-offs that I just don't want to make.
Mm-hmm. So true. And it's also, it's very good you mentioned about this of optimal to not optimal, but also then within that space, it's also the knowledge or the education, right? Which is also really important of going, cool, I want to go with 80% on my optimal level, right? But then also that's how far I want to go, but it also where you're feeding in the knowledge that you're taking in or consuming, right? To make sure that stuff is, because I believe in current society, irrespective of you in the, if you want to get healthy, if you want to get better, anything in your life, the knowledge that's coming in is almost more important than anything else. It's literally like water to our bodies, right? The knowledge that comes in, because the right knowledge will be a benefit. The wrong knowledge, even though you believe it's right, will be its total detriment. And the interesting part about this was many, many years ago, I bought LL Cool J's book he released. You know, LL Cool J, 90s rapper, ripped his shirt, still looks like that to this day. And he released a book in the early 2000s, and it was like, cool, here's my training guide, and here's my health guide, and I'd do it that any person on the street could do it, and you could follow it. And I was still in the gym scene, so I was like, cool, maybe there's something I'm missing because this dude is just jacked as anything, right? I got his book, and I got halfway through his book, and I literally put it down, and I sold it or gave away to a mate. But again, because his knowledge was like, hey, anyone can follow this. But in his book, he talks about, you know, I'm always, you know, cleaning, eating healthy and clean and all the rest of it. And I always try to make sure that. And then the one story was like, oh, I'm on the road a lot. So I need to look at good, healthy choices on the road. So I'm like, great. How do I get away from the takeaways and everything else? And then he was like, oh, no, I'll go into a diner, be on the road in America and stuff like that. And I'll let my chef come in and cook me a healthy meal. And I was like, fuck, bro. I was like, how the fuck is that relatable?
Yeah.
And then he tells a story about how he gets his chef to go into the kitchen and clean the grill so there's no leftover oil, and he reduces it. And I'm like, dude, are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
It's not a fuck relatable to the common man. And then I got to that point and I was already like, okay, this is going a bit sideways. The knowledge isn't relatable.
Yeah.
And then there was a few other things. And I didn't even finish. I fucking closed it and gave it away to a mate or something. I was like, the knowledge I was hoping to get was not relatable to where I was trying to get on to try to achieve for my target. And that's where I think in society today, it's that knowledge is so important. The right knowledge is so important in what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the arts of personal training is being able to take the health and fitness knowledge, which is fucking huge and deep, and trying to relay it to the person that's sitting or standing right in front of you. Right. Cause like we could list off all the scientific and most technical stuff, but if Lawrence isn't going to relate to it or digest it or even apply it, then what the fuck is the point?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, one more point on that before I get on to the high frequency club. Just on that, it's so true at understanding how differences are unique in every other people. So anyone that knows my backstory, brain tumor going on 4 or 5 years ago, my body has hormone imbalances and everything else from that side. One of the weirdest things is if I go vegan, and again, I've done this and it works, and I'm not saying I'm endorsing it because I don't think a vegan diet's the great diet. But for me personally, if I go on vegan, my body changes instantly almost. Like I'll lose weight like you cannot believe. And it supports my energy level spikes. Everything goes to the roof from the right levels. Don't ask me why, but you know, but it's weird because for my uniqueness and my situation and my condition, that one thing works for me and it's unstoppable for me.
Yeah.
So when I do get my focus right, I'll go like 3 months and I'll go on vegan and I'll lose like healthy 10 kgs, energy level, all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where something I'm conscious about. People go, oh, how are you doing? And all that sort of stuff. And you know, what are you on? I'm like, don't do what I'm doing. Because to me, it works with my situation. I don't support the diet. I just know with my condition, that's what it works with me.
Yeah.
And I don't say, hey, you should do it because you fucking hate it. And sorry to anyone that's vegan out there. You're going to, it's fucking horrible. But yeah, it's that uniqueness of each one of us is different. So the answer that we seek is different from the other person. And we need to shift away from that.
Yeah, yeah. One thing is for sure, the more whole food meals that we eat, the better it's going to be for us, right? But even too much of that is not going to be good for us. So it's just a matter of trying to pick a diet that best works for you, but also tailor it to your, as you have. Like I said, every 3 months or whatever, you're vegan. But all the other times, you're all good. You're not strict and rigid on one specific process. You've made it work for you. And it's the same for exercise. You don't have to stick to going to the gym every single day to, you know, to achieve your health goals. Mm-hmm. Well, depending on your health goals, right? But for the common person, going strength training twice a week and then having a variety of just movement activities that you really enjoy. And that can change in different chapters of your life as well.
Yeah. It's awesome. Talk to me about the High Frequency Club. What's the vision as a fellow podcaster yourself? And I know it's a 2-person show there. What's the vision?
I wish I could tell you, bro. So I can only really speak on why we started first was me and my co-host, who was also my partner, Shanae, we were just having these great chats. Yeah. And I always found myself having really good, deep, meaningful chats in like really isolated parts, like going to the bar or just hanging out with my mate at the park or at the gym. And I was like, man, I really want to have more of these chats. How can I create a vehicle to have more of them?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? A podcast. That'll be cool. Not only can I have more of the chats, but I can share it with other people. Mm-hmm. And also it's great for building my brand. And also good for people to understand what I do as a personal trainer in the actual session, because I'm not just the accounting weights. Like, I'm having these types of conversations, you know, so people get the vibe. And it's just gone from, you know, strength to strength, just getting guests from different, you know, codes or different backgrounds to share these stories. So what is the vision? Don't know. All I'm trying to do is amplify the passion that I have for it.
Yeah.
Wherever that leads to, bro, so, you know, come what may. But as long as I have a vehicle to connect with people, to contribute, to create, and to be curious, I'm happy.
Be curious. If you've ever watched Ted Lasso, it's one of his famous lines.
I've never seen that.
So anyone that's a Ted Lasso fan, there's the dartboard scene. If anyone knows exactly what he says, and it finishes off about be curious, because then you learn more about people.
Yeah, so. So that those types of questions always trip me out, bro. Like when people are like, "Oh, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Where do you see yourself in 10? I'm like, "Fuck! I just hope I'm happy. Yeah. I just hope I'm living up to my values. You know, I don't know what I'm gonna tangibly be at. You know, I don't know what country, I don't know what I'll be doing. Maybe I'm personal training, maybe I'm not.
Yeah.
But as long as I am fueled by those five values, I know I'll be sweet.
So what are the five values you speak about?
Connection, contribution, curiosity, and creativity.
Yeah.
Was there another one? Connection, contribution, creativity, curiosity, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing, man. So it's so true. You said at the moment it's happiness. But this happiness is not the same in 5 or 10 years' time.
Yeah. Because like what's making 31-year-old Marwin happy now may not necessarily be making him happy when he's 35 or 36, right? Like I'm thinking about, I can't be doing what I'm doing now if I have kids.
Yeah.
You know, I also want to go travel the world and maybe live somewhere else. Like obviously I'm rooted in where I am in my house because I PT there, you know, so I'm driven by knowing that my future self may not want what I have now, but I'm also content with being grateful for what I have achieved.
Yeah. Should blow it up like old Joseph Rakich, right? I had him on my show last year before he headed off to Dubai. So, you know, brought up the brand, from the personal training. And
He's the OG, right?
He's a legit guy, right? And I reach out to him every couple of weeks. It's going over in Dubai and it's, he's living the life, right?
Yeah,
Bought him that brand from nothing, from Les Mills days as well. Just over a decade ago from the work that he's done.
Yeah, he was like the first ever online trainer that I knew of anyway. And other people would say the same, that he was the first ever. So
No, his model's great. And I've spoken about it before which is quite an interesting human psychology piece. Mm. He gave everything away, like 99% of everything. His knowledge, the way he trained, was all in his emails and his videos, and he still does that to this day. But you know, he's not directly personal training. He sells different products now and services and all the rest of it. But the model was, because he gave people so much, they still wanted more of him.
Yeah.
And then that's the stuff, because people are so afraid in society today. They're like, cool, I'm going to give you a little bit because then I want you to buy the rest from me.
Mm.
And it's like, no, it works better when I give you my all and you can truly see what I'm trying to do and trying to support and trying to make you different. So when I do turn around and go, oh, by the way, that you can keep that there, or if you want to take a next step and come up to the next level with me, this is what it looks like. People are willing to walk through that door.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about us just giving as much, and then there's that next step, it becomes easier.
Yeah. Well, there's two sides to that conversation, right? The one side is, the more value you give, the deeper the rapport, you know, and that's where the personal really happens. I start to trust you, Lawrence. You've given me so much value in my life. I really want to invest in you. Mm-hmm. You know, at one point I will come into that conversion line where I spend my money on you, whatever product or service that you have. But that's the main thing. Value equals rapport and trust. And then the other side of that coin is, Gordon Ramsay can give me all the ingredients to cook the best gnocchi, the best pasta. Mm-hmm. I still cannot make it the same way he does. I'll give you all of my ingredients, but at the end of the day, I know how to cook my ingredients the best. So as we have built that rapport together, at some point you're going to ask for my help to help cook you, help me cook it at some point.
And to validate.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a big thing, right? We always want validation, or to make sure that we're going down the right path, because we always seek that, right?
Mm.
And again, it's coming a bit of a full circle down to, you know, parented and grown up. We always seek the validation from those in front of us or above us and stuff to make sure we're going down the right channels.
Mm, yeah, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's an important thing too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Marvin, as we sort of slowly get into the end of today's show, is there anything for our audience, you know, you want to leave them a thought or something you want to drop on them today?
Good question. I'd like to say to anyone that's listening right now who may have a health goal, I implore you to really investigate that and not hold your happiness or your confidence or your fulfillment in life hostage to you achieving your goal. For example, let's say you have a goal where you want to lose 5 kgs. And I ask you, what does that goal represent for you? What happens if you lose 5 kgs? Well, Marwin, if I lose 5 kgs, I'm going to be more confident, more happy, and more fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not wait until you've lost 5 kgs to be more happy, confident, and fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Let's start doing things in your routine, in your process, that's going to make you happy, confident, fulfilled now. That also aligns to that outcome. So every single day, do something that's going to make you feel those three ways.
Mm-hmm.
Don't wait. Don't wait, because let's say you wait until you lose your 5 kgs, then that's going to turn into 10, and then that's going to turn into 20. And then you've done your whole life trying to chase this one thing and never felt the way you've always wanted to feel.
Yeah, so true. Thanks for that, Marvin. And to everyone else, you know, as we come to the end of the show, I always say thanks for coming over to the Wolf Good Street podcast. But I always say at the end, it's to me, it's not about saying share this and like this and, all the rest of it that goes in part of it. It's about, is there something from today's story that is relatable to yourself? Is there something from today's story that is relatable to someone else you know that might need to hear it? And that is where it becomes important to help other people, to share the message to the one person that needs it. I don't care about 1,000 people sharing it. I care about the one person that needs it. But as always, thanks for coming over to the podcast, and hope to see you again.